Okay.
There we go.
Okay, the mic is on. So we are starting. Who is going to start reading the first case? You can come to the microphone, please.
Mr. C is a 47-year-old high school teacher who lives with his wife of 23 years. He describes a long history of rituals since childhood. For example, he feels compelled to do everything an even number of times. For example, eat two pieces of bread, fill a bag in four scoops, cover a distance with an even number of steps, and avoids the number 13 at all costs. His daily routine is also highly regimented. For example, when he wakes up in the morning, he showers, then shaves, then combs his hair. Any deviation from his rituals causes great anxiety related to the uncontrollable, repetitive, intrusive fears that significant others would otherwise be harmed. However, this anxiety is neutralized by the performance of rituals that compensate for the breach in routine. It is important to note that while these rituals are followed strictly and consume a great deal of time, his family and professional lives have not been significantly affected until recently.
Thanks. Next.
Mr. C's condition destabilized last May 13th. His problems began when he was raking leaves and was unable to fill an even number of bags, left with 3.5 bags filled, and thus unable to completely fill a fourth bag. He became very anxious. This anxiety was compounded by the fact that the incident occurred on the 13th of the month, thus creating a recipe for certain doom. In the ensuing weeks, he attempted to rectify this situation by performing his rituals with extreme zeal. He even added on rituals like washing his hands carefully in an attempt to diffuse this unprecedented crisis. However, despite these scrupulous rituals, he never gained a sense of control over the initial anxiety-producing situation, and his anxiety worsened.
As the summer began, Mr. C's anxiety dominated his life. He was spending approximately 3 to 4 hours daily performing his rituals, which affected his work performance. He had also begun forcing his wife to perform the same rituals, which created tension in the couple. He lost his appetite, which led to 15-pound weight loss, suffered from insomnia, fatigue, restlessness, and general inability to derive pleasure from anything. Gradually, he lost interest in all activities and became very withdrawn from his friends. In the week before coming to the hospital, he became consumed by the thoughts of suicide. The day before coming to the emergency room, he stopped his car on an overpass and considered jumping onto the expressway. He decided not to jump because he felt that there was hope in discovering the ultimate ritual that still would relieve his anxiety. The following morning, Mr. C related this story to a friend who accompanied him to the emergency room.
Thanks. Next.
Mr. C was admitted to psychiatry service for 6 days. During his stay, his wife was met for psychoeducational purposes and to engage her in participating in Mr. C's treatment. The latter repeatedly stated a desire to leave and required much reassurance and explanations by the staff. Finally, he discharged himself because he claimed that the ward milieu was not appropriate for him. Since leaving the hospital, Mr. C's symptoms remained well controlled.
You continue.
Okay. He continues to take two medications, fluvoxamine, Luvox, and clonazepam, Rivotril, that were prescribed in the hospital. His sleep and appetite are improved, but his energy, initiative, and concentration remain poor. He experiences moments of sadness, but generally feels numb. Moreover, the obsessions, including the May 13th incident, are less important to him now. He denies further suicidal thoughts.
Next.
Family psychiatric history, nil. On mental status examination, Mr. C was a well-groomed, tall, slim man wearing shorts and a T-shirt. He was cooperative and pleased to be referred back to me as I initially treated him in the ER. There was a vagueness in his descriptions of his rituals and difficulty speaking about the 13th. His speech was normal, but he was mildly agitated. No evidence of motor or vocal tics. Affect was often blunted. Occasionally sad. The thought form was normal. Thought content showed a decrease in obsessions of harm. No suicidal thoughts and no delusions. No hallucinations. Clear sensorium. Normal attention, but decreased concentration. Unable to do serial threes. Preserved memory. Fair to good insight and judgment.
Thanks. So the first question, what are the features in this man's history that lead us to a diagnosis? Okay? Can you speak louder? Okay. Uh-huh. So there is a combination of symptoms. Let's stick with the first constellation of symptoms. That is the obsessive. Yeah. So what are the symptoms here in terms of obsessive compulsive disorder?
The text mentions uncontrollable, repetitive, and intrusive fears that significant others will be harmed. So this could be considered like an obsession.
Exactly. So this is an obsession. What in what flavor the obsession can come? So this is an idea. Okay. What are the other kind of obsession that we can see in people? So it could be an idea. It could be
a ritual.
Well, a ritual is not an idea. It's not an obsession. It's a compulsion. Okay. In fact, rituals are not necessarily a compulsion. Okay, rituals are something that we do in our routines. Okay, or more so, it becomes compulsion when. When does it become a compulsion? It starts relieving the anxiety that is related to the obsession. And
if you don't do it, you're
yeah, if you don't do it, so you feel there is a word there for compulsion. You feel compelled to do them. So in compulsion, you feel compelled to do these rituals or these routines. Otherwise, the anxiety builds up, and then when you go for this compulsion, then your anxiety can go down. Okay, so we said that it could be ideas. What are the other forms of obsessions?
Impulses and
exactly, impulses. So there are compulsion of impulses. What does it mean, an obsession of impulsion? Go ahead. It means being afraid of having an impulse that you cannot control. So people often will have the fear of killing others or stabbing others, or you know, a lady with the children always having the fear to, for example, take a knife and injure her child. That's an impulse, or that's an obsession of impulse. So it could be an idea, it could be an impulse, and it could be an image. Exactly. So it could be an image. You know, some people have images of scenes that are imposing themselves on them, and so on. What is the main phenomenological characteristic that you need to have in order to make the diagnosis of obsession? Yes, it has to be recurring.
Does it impair functioning, normal
functioning? Impairing functioning. The person cannot ignore them.
I think the person knows that it's irrational, but it has to do it anyway.
Exactly. This is a very important feature of obsession. So there is a good knowledge that this is irrational. So whether they are the ideas, the impulses, or the images, people are not entirely under the reality of these things. Okay?
But if they were, what would that be called? Like, no? Well, maybe. What else? What? Exactly. So people with the personality disorder may have the same symptoms, like hating a certain number or checking things a million times, but they're happy about it. They don't see it as a problem. Whereas people with OCD, so they are very, very distressed by it, and they would love to change, but they can't.
Yes. There is a question there.
Just maybe I'll repeat that because that's important. So a syntonic symptom is something that the patient feels okay with and doesn't want to change. So that would be OCPD. And ego dystonic is something that you know is bad, you keep doing it, but it causes you distress. And that's OCD.
Okay. You have a question? Yes. Yes, they have insight, but they cannot. Yeah, the question was whether the patients with OCD have insight. Can you say that? Yes, they have an insight in the sense that they know that what they are living is something that is not normal. They know that these images are imposing themselves on them, but they know that they are not real, okay? And they would like to get rid of them. And oftentimes when they want to get rid of them, what happens? Yeah, that makes them anxious because they try to resist these images or these impulses. And the more they resist, the more actually these impulses and these ideas will impose themselves on them. And what else they do to get rid of these images and impulses? You have here your compulsion, exactly. So you have here the compulsion. Okay, good. So what are, yes?
The question was whether one of the features is guilt. It's not one of the diagnostic features, but it often happens. We collectively had this case that we were told about, that the children of a little 8-year-old who had this horrifying compulsions, images that he was going to rape and murder his entire family, which he was a very nice kid and he was completely terrified by it. But that was his kind of, the obsessive part were the images, and the compulsion is that he had to tell. So he would go to his mom and be like, hey mom, I feel the need to murder and rape you. So this caused a lot of distress in the entire family. And of course, it's very delicate to figure out whether this is actually, you know, a stated homicidal intent, you know, or whether it's just part of the OCD. But it was actually part of the OCD. So, and he felt horrible about it. No, he felt the need to go up to the family members and explain to them how much he wanted to murder and torture them. That was his compulsion. The obsession was an image, right?
That's the impulse, the obsessive impulses, that people fear that they are going to do that, but they're in control. So that's the impulse obsession is really having that fear that is very strong that you are going to commit something. But you know, in a sense, in the back of your mind that you are not going to do it. But this image keeps imposing itself. And in the case of the child, it's the image of that he is going to do, the rape in his family and so on, that is imposing itself on him. And that's the obsession. Yes? Sometimes it becomes quite severe, in fact, to make the differential diagnosis, because that insight might be not 100% there. And sometimes it's very difficult to differentiate between very severe obsessive ideas without insight and delusional disorder and delusions. Especially in the pediatric population. I think that's very important to know that all obsessive compulsive disorder are seen in children. Okay, there is in fact one syndrome that is called PANDA. Have you ever heard about? It's in fact. You've seen one. You can talk about it.
Well, it's probably over the scope of this lecture, and we do need to move on. But it's a post-viral, and you have a clinical presentation like OCD, except it's a follow-up after you've had strep throat or something like that, and then it actually coincides with increased antibody titers, and there's an immune hypothesis underlying it. But it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, what makes it interesting is, from a clinical point of view, it's a very rapid onset. So from the day to the next day, you'll see the onset of this very severe obsessive compulsive tic behaviors, and it's called PANDA. So that's okay. So have we covered the entire symptoms, or are there still some symptoms that you need to describe from the obsessive compulsive part?
I think we're good. I think the other one, there was a co-diagnosis, there was a comorbidity, somebody mentioned it, which is what? Depression, right? Okay. And we already know the features of depression. So what are the remarkable features on the mental status?
He has a blunted affect, plus or minus sad mood, decreased concentration, which is in the cognition part. But he maintains a good insight. So those were the three features I thought were relevant.
He is a bit agitated.
He's agitated indeed. So that's on the psychomotor exam part.
Avoidance of the 13th topic.
Still
the avoidance of the 13th topic would be where in the mental status exam? No, I don't mean where on the page, but where in the part of the mental status exam. It'd be in the thought, right? When you examine the thought content, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So normal attention and decreased concentration. Okay.
There is another feature in the mental status exam which is probably important to notice. It's been mentioned specifically. It's a negative symptom. Yeah, the lack of hallucination, but there is also another negative symptom that is more pertinent in this context, yes? Notics, yeah. Why is that an important negative symptom, notics? Yes? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, because in a good proportion of cases, people who have OCD might, in fact, have also Tourette syndrome. What is this proportion of the cases? 5 to 10% about people with OCD. And the reverse, if you have a person who has Tourette syndrome, what is the prevalence of what is the prevalence of OCD in people with 60%? Right. Okay.
So why are we giving this patient fluvoxamine and clonazepam? Etienne will now come and answer this here. Okay, anyone else? Come.
Okay, well, I have that fluvoxamine is an antidepressant. So it's a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So, and I found that it's used to treat OCD, major depression, and other disorders as well, like generalized anxiety, panic disorder, PTSD.
Excellent.
And do you want me to talk about clonazepam as well?
Yes.
So I have that clonazepam is a benzodiazepine, so derivative of benzodiazepine, and it's also prescribed for epilepsy and anxiety disorder and panic disorder. That's it. So the mechanism is it binds to the...
Can someone else talk about the mechanism of action of SSRIs? And thanks for...
So it does what? Mm-hmm.
Yes. What is the exact mechanism? Yes. So it basically it opens chloride channels and it increases the stability of the membrane and reduces the excitability of the cells. That's for clonazepam. Uh-huh. And for fluvoxamine. Exact, and we have discussed that last time.
What's the chronic effect of
SSRIs? What is the chronic effect of SSRIs?
Decreased receptor.
Okay. Which type of receptors? Which one, the postsynaptic or the presynaptic? The autoreceptor, the presynaptic receptors, and thereby leading to, is it the presynaptic? Huh?
The presynaptic autoreceptors.
Yeah.
So you decrease the presynaptic autoreceptor, you desensitize it chronically, and then you end up having over time increased serotonin function.
Oh, maybe the postsynaptic are a bit different from the presynaptic, we don't know. Maybe there are some mechanisms that make the presynaptic more sensitive to desensitization, but not the postsynaptic. Maybe there is a specific mechanism for endocytosis that is present in the presynaptic receptor for the presynaptic receptor, but is not present in. So there is a number of possibility that makes the presynaptic and the postsynaptic behave differently when you have an increased level of serotonin at the synaptic cleft. Okay, is that satisfactory? Yeah. We don't know, but yeah, okay.
So what factors may account for the patient's condition after leaving the hospital? What factors may account for the patient's condition after leaving the hospital?
The improvement of Okay. Very good. What else?
Supportive therapy from the wife, the psychoeducation from the wife could have helped in his recovery.
Okay, what else?
Mm-hmm. Reduced his anxiety
his
problem.
His energy remains poor enough to be from the benzodiazepine.
Okay.
Also, decreased concentration can be from the benzodiazepine.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. Increased sleep could be from the benzodiazepine also. Excellent.
And he had mild agitation. Which one is that?
SSRI.
What about it? Yeah. So the answer is you can have agitation as a side effect of the SSRIs.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that his obsessive compulsive symptoms are completely controlled or not yet?
Not yet.
Not yet, yeah. There is still some obsessive compulsive there. One of the features is that he's reluctant to talk about that. Is that something that is common in obsessive compulsive disorders? They have a compulsion to talk about it? Sorry, they have a compulsion to talk about what?
In the example that you gave about the child, he had his compulsion to talk about it. He felt the need to tell his
Yeah.
Family.
That's a specific case who had this feeling and this need. But most of the time, people with obsessive compulsive disorder are quite reluctant to talk about their obsession. And very often, you see that in the history of this case, it's been years and years that he had the symptoms, but they didn't come to the attention of the medical system, okay? And they're very reluctant to talk about that. And that has been reported in the mental states exam when he said that he was vague when he was describing his symptoms and not willing to talk about the 13. Most of the time, they're embarrassed to talk about their obsession, okay? What is the specificity of treating OCD with SSRIs in terms of dose and duration? I think it's in the discussion of the...
Not in
terms of dose specifically, how much, but often you need to give higher doses than the doses given for depression and for a longer period of time, so you don't expect much improvement in the beginning of the treatment, and you need to wait more than 6 weeks and with higher doses. Okay? Good.
So the last question is, what's the other effective treatment for OCD? Yes? There's something else before behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Right? So not just behavioral therapy, because that's a different kind. So Yeah, very good. So actually that little child ended up doing remarkably better after 8 sessions, which was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
That was Dr. McGill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Someone said surgery. Yeah. So surgery is also treatment for OCD?
For very, very severe OCD.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for very, very severe cases of OCD, surgery, psychosurgery is still an indication, and there are a few cases that are operated, I think, in the province of Quebec every year. What is the alternative for surgery? Not really electroconvulsive therapy. It's deep brain stimulation. Rather than putting, I haven't seen any people, I think, indicating electroshocks for OCD. Have you heard about that?
People will do. I think that sometimes when it's a delicate thing, because I think sometimes when people are not sure whether it's just really severe OCD or a form of psychotic depression that has this sort of obsessive cluster of symptoms, and people will try ECT, but deep brain stimulation is something that's going on right now. That's a rather hot area of research, and there are several centers. There's one at McGill. There's actually one here. They have about 12 patients or something like that with Dr. Kolifakis, and one in Toronto. And there, it's a hot new area. But unfortunately, I think the preliminary results, from what I remember, are not as fantastic as we would like them to be. And I think one of the take-home messages is that OCD I think in the minds of the experienced psychiatrist is the most difficult of all the psychiatric diseases.
It could be very severe. Okay, have we covered all the...
Yeah.
Okay, maybe because we still have a few minutes, I can ask other questions. What are the main themes that we see in the obsessions? We still have 20 minutes actually on this. What are the main themes? So we said that... Yeah, I know, but I timed everything here, so too.
Nice.
Yeah, so we still have 20 minutes that we can probably discuss further, and if the students have questions. So we said that obsession can come either images, impulses, or ideation. What are the main ideation that people will report in their obsessive-compulsive disorders? That's the impulse, okay? The impulse of killing, impulse of injuring others, impulse of okay, yes. Yeah, that's one of the idea. It's called magical thinking. You know, if I don't do this or if I don't skip this, then something bad will happen to others. Why is it magical thinking? Because there is no mechanic relationship between what you are going to do and what is going to happen, you know. So people have this magical thinking that is there.
I mean, it's magical if you think that avoiding cracks in the pavement will avoid, you know, your loved ones who have cancer. It's not actually magical to think that if you don't stab them, they're not going to be dead. So you have to, yeah.
Okay. What are the other obsessive idea that are often seen in our clinic? Yeah.
Oh, cleanliness.
Cleanliness, yeah. So basically the obsession is being contaminated by microbes, contaminated by solvents, contaminated by reagents and so on. And what will people do in this case as compulsion? Washing.
Washing.
So people will be washing. And so
you have that glove sign or whatever it's called when people have basically scrubbed their hands raw. Like you can tell the people with OCD in the emergency room because they're just completely, it's pretty awful actually.
Yeah, some people will come with lesions in their hands. They're using corrosive detergents, washing all the time, and they get injured. So that's one of the. Sometimes they are in the dermatologist actually clinic, and they don't say that they have this condition. So that's a dermatology diagnosis, obsessive compulsive disorder, in some instances.
There's one thing, if I may, there's one symptom which, in my very limited experience, I found very prevalent in the OCD people, which is what they can and cannot eat. And then, you know, you kind of have to make the difference between an eating disorder on the, you know, anorexia bulimia spectrum versus OCD. So I had this patient who... he's deteriorated to the point to which he was only allowing himself to eat four things, which were apple juice, apples, milk, and occasionally turkey. And then he was so afraid of contamination because everything else would lead to microbes in his throat. So that was his magical thinking. And then he was so afraid of inhaling microbes that he would only breathe on the side. That was his safe zone. So he would breathe over his shoulder because he didn't want to breathe the microbes of the people in front of him.
Another question, can you see obsession without compulsion and vice versa? Can you see compulsion without obsession, or are they always going together? Yes, the answer is yes. You can see compulsion without obsession and vice versa. In terms of compulsion, what is the most frequent compulsions that are observed in the clinical settings? Repetitive behaviors, but more specifically. So in this case, we have observed some compulsion, you know, filling, bags at exact, no, yes?
We forgot checking. So it's cleaning, counting, and checking.
Cleaning, counting, and checking.
If you have to remember something, it's that.
Yeah, so I was actually trying to find the checking with them.
Oh,
okay, cleaning, okay. Excellent. Questions about obsessive compulsive disorder? Yes? Yeah, an example of compulsion without obsession, someone who is checking 10 times whether he locked the door before going to job. And
It has to cause
haven't gone the 20th time, even though you know perfectly well that you've done it 19 times already, then...
And you are checking that...
There's an obsession behind that, isn't it?
What is the obsession? Not necessarily.
But, how can you tell there's no obsession?
You ask.
I thought that the compulsions were usually to relieve the obsession, the anxiety caused by
That's the thinking about it, but clinically, there are cases where you see that people are doing or are anxious and not having necessarily an obsessive idea in mind. Okay, so they're anxious and they're relieved after doing the checking of the door is closed, of the electricity is off, and that can take a lot of time. Okay, yes.
Let's say you come home, you close the door, and then before bed, you don't remember for sure if you locked the door or not. Then you go lock your door.
Well, if it happens once in a while, that's correct. But if it wakes you up in the middle of the night, few nights in a row, and then you are not sleeping well and not working well, then it becomes dysfunctional. Another type of compulsion that I've seen in children is the compulsion that the laces of their shoes need to be at the exact pressure left and right. And if they don't go out, if they don't go out without really checking 10 times, you know, and then they can pick crisis and crying if the pressure is not exactly the same. Or, yes? There is no thought content associated with it. It's really the idea of the pressure needs to be exactly the same and checking that. You're right. I mean, action and thoughts, you know, it's sometimes very difficult to dissociate what is behind and what is not behind. But some of the manifestation are more on the behavioral side, on the action side. Other are more in the brain side and internal representation. So that's the thing about that. Okay? Mental compulsion, yeah, counting, for example. So in order to relieve the anxiety, you need to count until 12, and then you need to repeat it, and then you need to repeat it. And the problem with compulsion is sometimes compulsion generates compulsion. It's not enough. So you have observed in this situation, in this clinical case, that when the anxiety becomes very high, he started doing this compulsion, and then it's not enough, and keeping doing more and more, and inviting his wife also to do it with him. Okay? Yes. Religious obsession are a very common thought theme in obsession. So people will have religious obsession, and then what goes with that is the compulsion that pray. Is to pray or the rosary. Yeah.
But it has to decrease the anxiety, right? So that's
Yeah.
I was going to say that's probably obsession of diseases are quite common in medical students, but they are fluctuating. Every pathology you go through, then you will have it, and then the day after you study another pathology and you have the other pathology. Therefore, it's not stable and it doesn't have the character of an obsessive disorder.
Okay.
You don't have obsessive disorder. Okay.
So maybe you would like to come and read the first paragraph of the second case. Are we on schedule, Dr. Schubert?
Okay, this is a 27-year-old single Haitian woman of Pentecostal faith who had been homeless for several months. She was brought to the emergency room by ambulance because she had been screaming in a shelter. When asked who she had been screaming at, the patient answered, "It's those damned spirits that won't leave me alone." She went on to describe a long history of hearing both male and female voices that commented on her every move, talked between themselves about her, and often said nasty things about her, calling her a whore. But she received no comments from these voices. She was convinced that these were the voices of evil spirits that wanted to harm her and control her body. As evidence of this, she reported feeling vibrations and pressure in her abdomen which she believed were the direct consequence of magic spells placed on her by the evil spirits. When asked why she was being bothered by these spirits, she replied that it was because of her special relationship with God. She also explained why nobody else heard them. In fact, she often saw illuminated silhouettes of human figures, which she believed were angels sent by God to protect her from the evil spirits. Her voices had become so constant that they prevented her from reading, watching television, and even awakened her during the night.
Thanks. Jihan?
Further history obtained with the patient's father revealed that her symptoms began during her last year of high school, following which her grades dropped and she became more withdrawn and uncommunicative, except for episode of talking to herself or screaming in her room. Was unable to hold a job for more than 2 months at a time because of lack of productivity, and had difficulty managing her finances, often asked her father for money. She was followed by a psychiatrist for 2 years at the beginning of her illness, and he prescribed a low dose of primazide, an antipsychotic, which only partly relieved her symptoms. However, the patient eventually discontinued follow-ups, since she did not believe that she had a mental illness. Her father was also pressuring her to just control the voices, stop the medication, and go to work. In fact, because he often yelled at her, she ran away from home on several occasions, usually living in shelters or on the streets.
Thanks. Olivia? Okay, come in.
Although there was no family history of diagnosed psychiatric disorders, her father presented as a suspicious man whose speech was difficult to follow. He had apparently managed to alienate himself from his siblings, often accusing them of mistreating him in some way. Exploration of the maternal family history was impossible since the patient's mother had abandoned her at birth. For the same reasons, perinatal history could not be obtained. On exam, besides the signs described above, we note a young black woman with a small belly and neglected hygiene, dirty clothes, body odor, dandruff, a puerile and indifferent attitude, no suspiciousness, absence of spontaneous speech, no agitation, blunted affect, coherent thought and process, poverty of thought content, no suicidal or homicidal ideation, decreased concentration and short-term memory, absence of insight into illness and poor judgment. During a review of symptoms shortly after admission, the patient reported a delayed menses. A pregnancy test was positive. A fetal ultrasound estimated that she was 14 weeks pregnant. She admitted to having unprotected sex with several men while living on the streets and could not possibly know who the father of her baby was. She professed a wish to keep the baby.
Thanks. Okay, the first question.
So what are the key symptoms and signs presented by the patient?
Okay, well, there's hearing voices and convinced that she was like...
Let's continue with the hearing voices. What is she hearing? There is a constant monologue. Is it a monologue? It's a dialogue. Okay. Uh-huh.
What do you call hearing voices? What would you call it formally?
Hallucinations?
Yeah.
Auditory hallucinations.
Yeah. And like it said that they're talking between themselves about her. So it's like how do you call that? Like she thinks like, yeah, but like she thinks
yeah,
they
talking
want...
between themselves, so hallucination, talking between themselves, the voices.
Okay.
But there is one specific hallucination here that we see often in people with psychosis. They're commenting on her. What she is doing, running commentary. That's okay. Something that is often observed, you know. You are doing this, you are doing that. Okay?
What's really important is that there's no command, because we often get patients who are told, you know, you are evil, you deserve to die. So that obviously places them in a different category of dangerosity, right? Like, you would be more likely to not let these people leave the hospital if they have a strong command hallucination that tells them to kill themselves or to kill other people. Mm-hmm. What other kind of hallucinations does this patient have? Okay, visual. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you call that vibration in her body?
Yeah, that's what I think. I don't think it's a hallucination. It'd be called a synesthetic hallucination, actually.
A what?
Synesthetic hallucination. Hallucination of movement. Okay. Having the impression that the body parts are moving.
So
it could be, but, you know, if the person is very much convinced that parts of her body is moving, then it's a synesthetic hallucination. Now, sometimes people have the impression that their movement is commanded by others, so they have this movement. So that's a syndrome of influence also that people can see. Okay? Somatic hallucinations are quite frequent also.
What other kind of somatic hallucinations are there? Okay. There's one in particular that I'm thinking of. This is called Read My Mind. Well, paresthesias can be either hallucination or a neurological symptom, right, for people who have had an injury or a central injury. But there's, have you guys heard of formication?
Sorry.
Formication.
Words
that are not what they sound like. Yeah, ants.
Yeah. Ants and bugs crawling on the body. You see that sometimes in people with schizophrenia, you see that specifically in people who are in pre-demented states, and also with drug abuse, psychosis with drug abuse, especially cocaine, you can have this formication and the impression that ants and bugs and are crawling on the skin. Yeah. Okay.
Haven't like somatic form disorder, like a pain disorder, pain that there's no cause of the pain?
Somatic form disorder will be, you'll have, yes, people feeling pain, but it will be very much isolated, and you don't see the other aspects that are associated with schizophrenia, like the hallucination, visual, auditory, and so on. Okay. But if it is in this composition of symptoms, then it is most likely to be somatic delusions. And again, there is a difference in terms of conviction, you know. Yes, people who have somatoform disorder can be, to a certain extent, convinced that they will have this behavior of going from doctor to doctor and so on. But it probably doesn't have the level of delusion. Okay? Do you think that, yes, let's... Sorry? Yeah, so we've been through the positive symptoms. These symptoms, hallucinations, does she have delusions also?
Yeah, I think she has religious delusion because she thinks she has a special relationship with God.
Yes, she has a religious delusion with a special relationship with God. It could be also qualified as grandiose delusion, because if you have special relationship with God, you are grandiose.
But that's delicate, because people who believe think that they have a special relationship with God, so...
When it comes to religious themes, it's always delicate, because it's a very common belief. what other delusions that she...
did say, though, that she often saw illuminated silhouettes of human figures.
Yeah, that's not delusions.
No, but it's a hallucination, I guess?
Yeah. What kind of hallucination is illuminated silhouettes of something figures? Visual, yeah, okay.
She ties into which she believed were angels sent by God. So that's why
right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part of the delusion. So then you see very often that there is a dynamic between hallucination and delusions. There is the hallucination of seeing this eliminated figures, and then there is the delusional interpretation. It's God who is sending them to her.
It's, if I may interject, there's something actually interesting about this case, which is the Pentecostal faith, and there's it's always a really good question to ask on exams. Can anyone read my mind now? Yeah. Right. So what's that called? Speaking in tongues and having religious fits. What's that called? Well, the speaking in tongues part. So it's a psychiatric symptom called glossolalia, which I will spell. Glossolalia. And the interesting thing about it is that glossolalia is considered a psychiatric symptom unless it's in the context of the Pentecostal faith, because that's actually part of the faith. So this is actually in a DSM-4. And it's a good exam question because it's like this fun fact. I will now spell it.
I'm not Pentecostal. I've never seen that. So.
I'm not Pentecostal either, but it's on exam.
Yeah, it's something that is true. Actually...
Right, so during their religious services, they will get up and they will start speaking...
I really don't know. I've never witnessed that, but a friend of mine told me that lately. He said that.
Don't you guys have computers everywhere?
Yeah, on YouTube. It's like
his. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a very interesting observation. Mm-hmm. Okay, so. Let's move. What are the negative symptoms that are observed in this situation? First of all, what are the negative symptoms?
And what are the positive symptoms?
What are the positive symptoms? Okay.
Can you define negative and positive symptoms for us? Okay.
From what I understand, the positive symptoms are things that are added to normal behavior.
Exactly.
So here, like the delusions and the hallucinations. And negative symptoms are when there's something that you should normally be doing that you're not doing. So here I think withdrawal and uncommunicative would be examples.
Excellent. It's exactly that. So positive symptoms are things that normally you don't see and that are observed in people with psychotic disorder. And negative symptoms are normal functions that are either reduced or completely abrased in people with psychotic disorder or other mental illness. Okay. So the negative symptoms here, you said withdrawn. What is that? Not having social contacts, withdrawn. What is it called? Asociality. Okay. Not talking or talking very little. What is it called in terms of symptoms? Ilogia. That's right. And there is also the symptoms of a blunted affect. And apathy. Apathy is the lack of volition, not having the will of doing things. Okay.
The negative symptoms you have the four A's.
The four A's. Okay, great. What is the other type of symptoms that we can see in this clinical picture and that have been described here? So we have the positive symptoms, we have the negative symptoms. These are the two classical dimensions of psychopathology in this kind of disorder. And the other is cognitive deficits. Here, what did we see in terms... Sorry? Yeah, the grades drop. That's inflection. Maybe it is related. It could be related to cognitive deficit, or it could be related to the psychotic disorder. You know, it's not necessarily related to the cognitive deficits. But in terms of what is described in the case, what poverty of thought content, it's in fact related to the negative symptoms, poverty of thought content. And how can you assess that? Poverty of thought content. Is it the same thing than alogia, poverty of thought content? How can you differentiate between poverty of thought content and alogia?
Well, if you're still talking, but
yes.
You're not
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, poverty of thought content is then people can talk a lot, but their discourse could be very little informative. So that is, the content of thought is very poor. Okay? Excellent. And it's considered part of the negative symptoms. Does she have disorganized speech?
Yeah, very good.
So,
that speech. So I guess you guys haven't really learned the different parts of the mental status exam, but remember when I said that they're just different, they're like different organ systems, they're just different systems of the psychiatric examination. Thought is one of them and speech is the other. So, but I guess you'll learn that later. Sure. Mm-hmm. The question is, what are the cognitive symptoms?
Them, decreased concentration and decreased memory. Okay, and most of the time what you see is also abstract thinking is very poor. And how you probe abstract thinking? Yeah, the classical one is people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, and then they will have a concrete interpretation of this. Okay, that's the poverty of abstract thinking that is also reported in psychotic disorder. So what is the most likely diagnosis? Yes.
So the question is, what are insight and judgment are considered in the cognitive category? Sort of, but no, when you write down a formal status exam. Like, obviously, they're cognitive things, but cognition usually has to do with intellectual functioning, so we'll do tests to test memory and abstraction and things like that, whereas insight and judgment are different things. So insight is, do you think you're sick? How do you feel about your condition? And judgment is, well, what are you going to do? And if they say, you know, fly to Barcelona and become king, then their judgment isn't that good.
Yes. It could be both. Usually the deficit syndrome is very important in the lack of productivity. When you have apathy, allogia, lack of volition, then you are not going to work. We know that negative symptoms are most correlated with productivity and functioning, but also cognitive symptoms are very much related to productivity. In contrary, positive symptoms are not very much related to the functional outcome of people. So people who have hallucination or delusion sometimes can continue to be functional and continue to work and continue to go to school sometimes. But really what gives a hit on the functioning is the negative symptoms and the cognitive symptoms.
We have several patients who are recurrent, they come back and forth at the MGH, at the MUHC in general, who have several master's degrees and schizophrenia. So it's possible. It's not likely, but it's possible. Unfortunately, not likely.
Anyone else? So what is the most likely diagnosis? Yes?
Schizoid personality disorder.
Oh, that's an interesting. So who votes for schizoid personality disorder? You are alone. That's very good. That's a very good answer. Who says another diagnosis? It's a schizophrenia. She meets very well the criteria of schizophrenia. What form of schizophrenia? Paranoid schizophrenia. What are the different forms of schizophrenia that you...
Paranoid, disorganized, catatonic.
Uh-huh. There is one missing. And differentiated, so paranoid, disorganized, and differentiated, and catatonic schizophrenia. So in this case, why do we say that she has paranoid schizophrenia? Yes, because there is a predominance of positive symptoms. In particular, there is hallucination, delusions, they are very prominent, disorganized behavior. The other thing that we didn't talk about actually in this case, there is disorganized behavior. What is the disorganized behavior that she has here? Well, she was screaming in the hall. Uh-huh. She was having sex with different unprotected sex with different people. We don't. So that's part of the disorganized behavior. Sometimes disorganized behavior can go very severe. You know, you see sometimes people on the streets collecting garbage and hoarding stuff, and you know, moving. That's the kind of extreme disorganized behavior that you can see in schizophrenia. Okay, it could be agitation. It could be okay. I'm following a bit the discussion on that, but I didn't know whether it will be there or not. Most likely, I think it's quite a stable classification. I don't think that it will be removed from the next classification system, the different dimension. It's been there for years, and yeah.
She almost meets the criteria for like manic episode, right?
Does she?
Almost, because she's
grandiosity, potentially. Did you mention that? Yeah, there is some grandiosity in terms of believing that God is, you know, on her side. But is the mood elevated?
No, but she has irresponsibility as well. Because I thought for the manic episode, not that she's manic, but the manic episode, you have to have three or more of the whole list of criteria, so she almost has that.
Yeah, but I think the manic episode, really, you need to look at the mood. And does she have elevated mood? That's a very important criteria. And does she have a goal-directed behavior also? This is very disorganized behavior. And the hallucinations are very atypical for a manic episode. Okay, she has many of them, delusion of religious content and so on. So that's probably not the case. Okay, so paranoid schizophrenia with predominant negative symptoms also. She has quite a bit of negative symptoms. What is the lifetime prevalence of schizophrenia? 1%. Is that high?
Yeah.
Always compared to what high? It could be very low if you compare it to diabetes in the general population. It could be very high if you compare it to very rare diseases like PKU. So, yes, it is quite prevalent condition, you know, in the general population.
Nothing compared.
To social anxiety, right. For example, which is much, much more prevalent. But schizophrenia is 1%.
More men, more women?
Equal.
Equal. Very good. So what do we know about the underlying mechanisms of schizophrenia? What do we know about the mechanisms underlying schizophrenia?
The brain mechanisms underlying schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. Increase dopaminergic activity.
Mm-hmm. So, you want to structure the answer in categories, so you can have like, no, they say, for once, no, biopsychosocial is not the answer for once. I guess it could be, but you look at the etiology, like the. Genetic predisposition, perinatal factors, infections, things like that, and then you can look at the molecular pathophysiology, at the hormones. So, looking at the pathophysiology, we have the you mentioned what?
Well, I think it's really very unknown.
Right, but what is it that we have as hypotheses? Right. So maternal infection? Fetal hypoxia, very good.
Urban birth.
True, though. Okay. Yeah.
Head trauma?
It's
yeah.
Reported in the literature.
It's associated.
Everything probably that you can name has been reported in the literature. That is, cannabis use in adolescence is another risk factor.
Paternal age.
Excellent. It's been reported in the literature. Uh-huh. Okay, so resistance and compatibility during pregnancy has been reported. Immigration status has been reported as a risk factor. There are a large number of risk factors that have been reported. Birth in winter has been reported also as a risk factor. Sorry?
decreases vitamin D. Some people are working on that, and they relate that to the migration, actually, because people who migrate to the northern hemisphere are dark-skinned, and therefore they don't take the vitamin D, and that could be a risk factor, especially for the second generation migrants. Mm-hmm. So there is a host of risk factors that have been reported. The most important one is the genetic risk factor, and the heritability is still, one of the most robust risk factors in schizophrenia.
And then in terms of the molecules, the neurotransmitter, the hormones, what is it? Dopamine, right? Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, glutamate.
Sure. We had a 3-hour lecture this morning on this.
It wasn't this morning, fresh, yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. And in terms of neuroanatomy, yes. Well, be careful. Most cases are sporadic, but if you have a patient, if you have a brother or sister who has schizophrenia, your risk is 10%. So that's 10 times increase compared to the general population. And if you have a monozygotic twin who is affected with schizophrenia, then your risk is about 40%. Yes. That's about 40 times more than the general population. So that's a very, very important risk increase. Do you know, I'm going to ask my usual question, do you know what is the most robust risk factor that has been reported in medicine? you can say oxygen for that matter, you know. Oxygen kills us all. No, actually it's smoking and lung cancer. And smoking and lung cancer, what is the increased risk for people when they smoke? It's 10 times. No, it's 10 times, 10 times more. If you are a smoker, you have 10 times more risk to develop lung cancer. So keep that in mind, because that will help you to put these relative risks, you know, in perspective. And when you say if you have a monozygotic twin who is affected, your risk is increased by 40 times, that's quite substantial compared to what is known as a very, very strong risk factor in medicine.
Okay.
Exactly. Sporadicity is not a good reflection of the genetic contribution. Okay? Good. Let's move.
So question 4, the biopsychosocial formulation. Kind of. So let's look. So I'll write the table down, actually.
Perpetuating, and then protective.
Okay.
So then this is how you do it. Try to fill this in.
Now we're doing the treatment plan over taking.
It says biopsychosocial formulation? No?
This one? It says.
Oh, biopsychosocial treatment plan. Well, same. I mean, you need this in order to get the other one. Can anyone think of filling any of the little squares? There's 12 of them.
Well, predisposing would be the social class.
Is social class associated with schizophrenia?
Yeah.
It's discussed. Let's concentrate on the major ones that are shown here.
So that's very good. So then maybe a family history. Maybe a family psych history.
How do you know that she has a family psych history from this case?
Because her father is suspicious.
Yeah, the father is very suspicious. He alienated himself from the rest of the family, and when he's talking with you, his thought was kind of unclear and okay.
And social, can you say immigrant status?
We don't know how when she emigrated, but maybe immigrant status, and that would be social.
Social.
Maybe immigrant status.
Yeah.
It's, by the way, not... I don't think you need to know this, but it's the first and the second generation immigrant, so it actually goes with the children of people who immigrated as well.
And it's possible
What's that?
The Pentecostal, is it?
It's like a very involved religion. So, talk
so wouldn't that be protected, that you have a nice religious community and... So what would that be? Predisposing, precipitating, perpetuating, or protective? So do you guys know the difference between those four words?
Yeah.
Okay, so just quickly. So predisposing would be obviously, you know, I think it's intuitive, so things that predispose you to have something. Precipitating, when you talk about a precipitant, it has to do with the actual event. So, you know, husband's death precipitated depression, something like that. Then perpetuating is, well, husband death precipitated depression, and it's perpetuated by the fact that everyone else in her family hates her. And so she's not getting better because no one is there supporting her. And protective would be, but she has good friends, something like that.
So can perpetuating the fact that, like, she can't have a job, like, she can't keep a job for 2 months, and she...
So you could say social isolation? Something like that is perpetuating?
She's homeless also, so perpetuating.
Homelessness.
Like she's not getting care as well.
Yeah, so that would be social homelessness.
And father yelling at or stopping her medications could be biological.
That's very important. So it's biological because medication has a biological effect, dopamine, serotonin, etc. Actually, this is a...
Perpetuating.
Precipitating because... Non-compliance can precipitate.
The episode.
You know? So episode. So it's. I mean, this is obviously very fluid. But let's put meds here. Meds. DC. Discontinue.
Pressure from her father to stop the medication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the father was kind of dismissive and stop your voices and go and work. So he.
That would be kind of like a perpetuating, precipitating psychological factor.
Oh. High EE. That's part of the high EE.
She also lost her job. That could be a precipitation. Maybe not losing her job. Could also be precipitation.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So what? Social losing job.
What's high EE?
What is high EE? We've heard it several times.
Like the father constantly criticizing and yelling.
It's kind of
revised all this theory. I think it's been very very meditated at one point, the high EE, and its role in basically precipitating relapse of psychotic symptoms. There is not much evidence now because it could be also related to the genetic factors. You know, people are very emotional because they have this genetic predisposition, and that also gets people in the illness in the first step. So, yeah.
What's confusing?
No, it's just like it's not confusing, it's just like very complicated.
Yeah,
that's all it.
But that's why it takes 10 years to become a specialist in something.
Substance abuse. Does she have substance abuse in the description? Did we talk about? No.
Is it the fact that she's pregnant could be protected? Because her focus would be on what the...
But then do you really think she's going to be doing compliant with her prenatal care and doing all the right things for the baby?
Haven't you also learned that when people are pregnant, sometimes there are symptoms?
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Hormonally, they're
That's
all over
true.
The place.
You're absolutely right. We see sometimes people...
Well, actually, you're saying two different things and both are true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one way when someone's pregnant, usually like they're negative, whatever is wrong with them is kind of masked. Because your body can be adjusted.
Uh-huh.
But then also the social circumstances, right? This is why we have formulations. So biologically, yes, pregnancy can have a calming effect. You know, for example, in psychiatry, I'm not so sure, but definitely in things like autoimmune diseases, they will calm down a lot, or other pathology. But socially, it can be very,
very stressful also.
Stressful and disconcerting, especially in a religious world, right?
Biologically could be precipitating for a bunch of mental illnesses because there's like your hormone.
Let me
Yeah, let me clarify this. Biologically, pregnancy is protective against most of mental illnesses. When women are pregnant, even sometimes you can see a very flawed psychotic disorder that completely disappear when during pregnancy. However, postpartum is very prone to complication of psychiatric disorders. So during pregnancy, they will see their symptoms go down, but they are at very high risk of severe psychotic relapses and mood disorders after giving birth. Why? Because it seems that the estrogens and progesterones are protective, and after giving birth, there will be a sharp decrease in these hormones, and that will be the brain and the mental life at very high risk. Okay? So these are the two aspects that... Okay? It could be that people who are at high risk of depression after the postpartum, they are more likely to develop this depressive symptoms and depression. You know that postpartum blue is very common, not necessarily, and sometimes that will even develop to severe mental illness in a few minority of cases. Yeah, it's very bad. Okay, so discuss the elements of, so we have already done that. And what are the elements for treatment? Before going to the antipsychotics, here you have a pregnant lady who is psychotic, who has very, very important difficulties in life. By the way, can you see delusional pregnancies? Yeah. It could be something that you can see, so.
Fascinating.
Yeah, the delusional pregnancies. Oh, yeah.
It can be very elaborate.
I have a patient who's been pregnant for years now, so. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the delusion. And it could be fascinating, yes, and pregnant with many children and giving birth and pregnant again, and delusional pregnancy are quite something.
And it's one thing when you have somebody who has been pregnant for years, so everybody's like, oh, okay, well, I guess you haven't really been pregnant for years. But sometimes people will want a baby so badly that they will convince themselves, their partner, everyone that they're pregnant. And then they falsify prenatal tests and they show their coworkers ultrasounds and all of that. It can get very, very elaborate. And they want to believe it so hard that it becomes real. And then, obviously, at the due date time, there's some giant psychological decompensation.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Okay.
And actually, on the other side, there are people who really, really don't want to be pregnant. So there are people who give birth while having been in denial for 9 months that they've been pregnant. And I've seen one of those cases. It was really awkward. Because, you have abdominal pain. Here's the baby.
Complete denial of pregnancy and of giving birth. Okay, so then in treatment,
Exactly.
They deny completely that they have a baby and it's not mine.
It doesn't exist. Because of that. There's no baby. To get an abortion, you have to have a fetus, right?
It's not because you have something there that you believe that it is there.
There are
quite a number of probably infanticides that are related to this kind of postpartum psychosis. And okay, so first of all, the basic needs, food, shelter, cleanliness, bathing, finding place for her. The psychosocial needs are extremely important in this case. This is a pregnant lady and she needs all that. In terms of medication, what would be your orientation? Yeah, she's pregnant and we have to be very, very careful with what you give as medication. What is the general rule when you have something who is pregnant?
Nothing.
Huh? Well, first of all, yeah, exactly. Give them nothing if they are capable of tolerating that. But what is the other downside of not giving them anything? Because it could be true. I have a pregnant lady who has psychosis now, young lady, and she's not taking anything, and we are helping her with, supporting her psychotherapy, dealing with her anxiety, being there, most of the time, and it's working well. But if you are not capable of controlling the psychotic symptoms. Exactly. It could be very much harmful for the baby for psychological reasons, because as we discussed earlier, there could be a denial of the child, and therefore the mother is not going to care for him when he's born. The lady is.
You guys remember those babies flushed on the toilets in airplanes? There was a bit of an epidemic of that a couple of months ago.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Three babies in airplanes.
Okay. Uh-huh. So then you need to balance really between, the need of treating a lady who's psychotic and pregnant and to prepare her for basically having her child and the harm that a treatment or a medication can bring to the child, okay? Mm-hmm. Oh, this is.
How do you assess her capacity to take care of a child, and what are the decisions that you have to make?
This is a very interesting question. I think that what about the decision of keeping the child or not? Who has the right to do this decision?
Her.
It's exactly her. It's exactly her. I think it's very important.
What Etienne is saying.
I'm not talking about the decision.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, very good.
Absolutely.
So then people, remember, I don't know if we've really went into this, but there's something called capacity, which we as psychiatrists are able to evaluate, and then the final decision goes to a judge, but we're able to do reports on it. Capacity is something that can include a lot of things like taking care of your own medical needs. You know, you need an operation to save you. You say no because, an angel told you not to. So something like that. It can have to do with, your finances, whether you're able to live independently. And in this case, it has to do with the care of minors, right? Are you able to provide for the needs of this child who eventually will be born? So then I'm not sure of, there would be a child psychiatrist involved, obviously a perinatal psychiatrist who's involved, and there are specialists in that, and they would be able to say, because of course if she is completely and utterly disorganized and unable to take care of her basic needs, she won't be able to care for a child, and then something needs to be done, right? As society, we have to protect that kid and protect the patient, of course.
So basically there will be a signaling for the DYP, la direction de protection de la jeunesse, and there will be an evaluation of her capacity to care for the child, and there will be a decision, and the judge, given the information from different protagonists, will make a decision whether the child can be still with his mother or not. But if her capacity to care for her child are very poor, then most likely the child will be adopted by the Yeah, what type of drugs in this case you will give? The safest is probably the oldest, and from the oldest we have Haldol. That is a medication that has been used quite extensively in pregnant women, and there is not much evidence for that. Phenothiazines like Largactyl have been associated with some problems, so in this case, probably giving her the oldest medication, one of the oldest medication, haloperidol would be an appropriate. But then also you have to balance, because you can give haloperidol, and at the same time you will have a child who will be born with motor problem and extrapyramidal side effects. You have to be very careful about that. Yes. We don't have a lot of data about these medication. We've been using the atypical antipsychotic medication in the last probably now 15 years, and I will prefer to go with an older medication that is effective for the psychosis and known not to be harmful for the child. That being said, you need always to go to your databases. You need to up to date and.
Has a really good phone number. So
yeah. Yeah, you can ask about if you are in doubt to prescribe antidepressant medication or antipsychotic medication. You can always call the number. Okay. Yes.
Would you hospitalize this patient?
Would I hospitalize this patient? Yeah, most likely I will. I mean, if she's in a very poor condition of hygiene and you know she came and she's tired, she doesn't have a shelter, I will keep her in the hospital for some time, for sure. Until the situation, because you are not going to be able to solve also all the social problems like that. You need some time to find a solution to different kind of problems, and then keeping her in the hospital for some time. It's a good indication for keeping her in the hospital, okay?
But you wouldn't necessarily be able to keep her against her will.
Yeah. If she refuses to be hospitalized and you don't have arguments to say that she is dangerous for herself or others, you cannot keep her. You brought a very good point here. Yeah. But I think a judge will be sensitive to this argument. If you say that the lady is pregnant and she is doing harmful things and not eating properly and putting the fetus in danger, yes, the fetus is not recognized legally as a person, but I think given that she has a mental illness that deteriorates her judgment, I think a judge will be sensitive to keeping her in the hospital against her will.
So, the answer to, is there a number of weeks of pregnancy? So the answer to that, and the precedent was a few cases with midwives when a child died after the head was delivered but not the shoulders. A fetus or a, you know, baby about to be born is not a person under Canadian law until both shoulders are delivered. There's a...
Yeah.
But that's what it is. That's the law right now. So the... I mean, it's in Quebec. I don't know if it's the rest of the Canada, but definitely in Quebec.
Hillel, this is a specific answer for you. Yes, things are cut after the shoulder.
Both.
Two shoulders. Then it is an entity. Before the two shoulders, it's not. Okay.
We can go into that. That's actually an obstetrical maneuver. But. I'll tell you this. So once both shoulders are delivered, usually that's the hardest part, but there are cases in which the head is out, which is relatively easy, but then the shoulders won't come out. And that's called a dystocia, that you don't need to know this for psychiatry. But basically, there are numbers of, this is an obstetrical emergency because both the mother and the baby can die very quickly. So there are numbers of maneuvers to deal with that, and if you don't, as a last resort, like maneuver 6 out of 7 is pushing the head back in and getting an emergency surgery. This is like crazy heroic, etc.
Yona was a gynecologist before becoming a psychiatrist.
It's true.
Okay. So we talked about the medication. What else needs to be done in her case, you know?
Psychoeducation.